With that, our attention turned from meeting Kim Jong-un to attending the G7. It turned out the road to Singapore was paved with the ruins of Charlevoix. The G7 meetings and similar international gatherings had a rhyme and reason at one point in history, and at times do good work, but in many respects, they have simply become self-licking ice cream cones. They're there because they're there. On June 8th, Trump was over an hour late leaving the White House on Marine One for Andrews. Air Force One landed at the Bagotville Canadian Air Force Base, from which we helicoptered to the summit location, the Fairmont Le Marois Richelieu in La Malbaie, Quebec, still about an hour late. It seemed like a nice location, pretty much in the middle of nowhere. Not that it mattered. As usual, we only saw the inside of the spacious hotel where all seven heads of government and their delegations stayed. Trump arrived fixated on inviting Russia to rejoin the G7, from which it was expelled in 2014 after invading and annexing Crimea. He found an ally in Italy's new prime minister, Giuseppe Conte, on the job less than a week before arriving at Charlevoix. Conte was in office because of an unusual left-right populist coalition that made Italian politics some of the most unstable in Europe. The G7 opening plenary sessions were contentious, with Trump under siege for his trade policies, until he fired back. The G7 should abolish all tariffs, all non-tariff trade barriers, and all subsidies. That subdued the Europeans in particular, who had no intention of doing any such thing. The discussion really showed the rampant hypocrisy of international trade talks, where free trade was invariably good for everyone else, but not for favored domestic sectors, particularly farmers in places like France and Japan, not to mention the U.S. and Canada. Trump had bilateral meetings with Canada's Trudeau and France's Macron, where the conversations on bilateral trade were far from amicable. Trump didn't really like either Trudeau or Macron, but he tolerated them, mockingly crossing swords with them in meetings, kidding on the straight. I assume they understood what he was doing, and they responded in kind, playing along because it suited their larger interests not to be in a permanent tiff with the U.S. president. Trump rightly complained to both that China did not play by the applicable rules in international trade and had gotten away with it far too long. With Canada, Trump wanted the new North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, ratified, which would largely satisfy his trade objectives with Mexico and Canada. With France, Trump's real target was the EU. As usual, he trotted out that old standby. The EU is worse than China, only smaller. Trump also complained about China and many other WTO members that called themselves developing in order to take advantage of more favorable trade treatment. This was only one of many areas where the WTO could stand thorough reform, which the other G7 states professed to support, but never quite got around to. Trump ended the Macron meeting by saying, "You know, John's been preparing all his life for this job. He was a genius on Fox TV, you know, and now he's got to make hard decisions, which he didn't have to do on TV, but he's doing a great job." The French got a kick out of that. So did I, for that matter. In true G7 fashion, there was then an elaborate dinner for the leaders, followed by a Cirque du Soleil performance. I skipped all the fun to continue preparations for Singapore. Unfortunately, also in true G7 fashion, the Sherpas, the senior officials responsible for the substance of the summit, were gridlocked on the traditional final communique. The Europeans loved playing games with these communiques, forcing the U.S. into the unpleasant choice of either compromising on core policy principles or appearing isolated from the others. For most professional diplomats, being isolated is worse than death, so compromising principles looked good by comparison. Another fate the Europeans couldn't contemplate was not having a final communique at all, because if there was no final statement, maybe the meeting never took place, and how terrible that would be for mankind. Therefore, instead of enjoying Cirque du Soleil the other leaders began harassing Trump, complaining that the U.S. Sherpa was being hardline. The dinner had also been contentious, with the other leaders opposing Trump's ill-conceived idea of bringing Russia back into the G7, and the mood had grown somewhat churlish. Since the G7 was originally conceived in the 1970s as a forum to discuss economic issues, most of the work fell to National Economic Council Chairman Larry Kudlow. The U.S. Sherpa and his international economic staff reported jointly to Kudlow and me. Trump should have said, "Leave it to the Sherpas and let them work all night." He concluded, however, since he was a closer, he and the other leaders would gather in one of the lounges and negotiate themselves. By this point, Kudlow had joined the group with the aim of being friends with the European leaders on international economic issues. Kelly, sensing trouble, sent for me at about 10:30 p.m. As I was walking in, Kelly was walking out saying, "This is a disaster," which, after a few minutes of observation, was clear. The leaders were on plush couches and chairs, with several dozen aides hovering around. No good could come of this. Trump himself seemed very tired. In fairness, so were many others, but not Macron and Trudeau, and certainly not their aides, who were pushing policy agendas contrary to ours. This was déjà vu for me. I had engaged in scores of these slow-moving debacles over the years. I tried to judge whether Trump really wanted a G7 communique and would therefore make more concessions, or whether he was indifferent. I couldn't tell, but Trump, who had not troubled to prepare himself, didn't really have much of an idea what was at stake. By the time I arrived, Trump and Kudlow had already given away a number of hard-fought positions. I intervened on one point against a German idea on the WTO, but no one really seemed to understand what was at issue, reflecting that it was not Trump alone who didn't grasp the specifics of what the Sherpas were debating. Finally, at about 11 o'clock, the leaders agreed the Sherpas should continue on their own, which they dutifully did until 5:30 a.m. Saturday. I would have said, "Why bother? Let's just not have a communique," which might have brought Europe and Canada up short. But as Jim Baker would have reminded me, I was not the guy who got elected. I found Kudlow and our Sherpa at about 7:20 a.m., and they confirmed not much had happened overnight. Because Trump woke late, however, we did not have a briefing session before G7 events resumed. I still didn't mind leaving Charlevoix with no communique, but I wanted to be sure Trump understood the implications. We never had that conversation. Instead, I suggested we advance the time of our departure from Canada to 10:30 a.m. in order to force a decision. We were already leaving well before the G7's scheduled end, so we could arrive Sunday evening in Singapore at a reasonable hour, and I was just suggesting leaving a bit earlier. My theory was that once out of the summit's hothouse atmosphere, Trump could decide more calmly how to handle the communique. Kelly and Kudlow agreed. Trump was already bored, tired, and late for a breakfast on gender equality. Upon hearing of his accelerated departure, the Europeans who had other ideas descended before we could spirit him from the room. The now famous picture, taken by Germany, shows we didn't get him out in time. It felt like Custer's last stand. The whole thing was a waste of time, but on and on the discussions went, with Kudlow and me doing most of the negotiating. We picked up nickels and dimes, eliminating a European provision that Iran was in compliance with a nuclear deal, which it was not. But basically all we did was produce carbon emissions that simply contributed to global warming, which the Europeans professed to be concerned about. Trump was still bored, but we agreed on a final document, and off we went for a press conference before boarding Marine One and heading back to Bagotville Air Force Base, leaving Kudlow behind to hold the fort. We joined up with Pompeo, and Air Force One left for Singapore, 12 hours ahead in time zones, via NATO's Suda Bay base on Crete for a refueling stop. We were done with the G7, I thought. Trump was delighted to be on his way to meet Kim Jong-un. Once we were airborne, I explained to Pompeo what happened at Charlevoix. I tried to nap to adjust to Singapore time and awoke on Sunday Greek time shortly before landing at Suda Bay. Except for POTUS, Air Force One is not designed for luxury travel, with no lie-flat seats, and many people simply stretched out on the floor. While I was asleep, Trump had fired off two tweets withdrawing support for the G7 communique, which was unprecedented. He had had Pompeo awakened some hours earlier to come to his office, where he was throwing a fit about Trudeau's closing his press conference to score points against him. Trump had been gracious to Trudeau in his press event, and he was infuriated Trudeau had not reciprocated. The communique was collateral damage. No one rousted me, and when I did wake, I obviously couldn't recall the tweets, which predictably dominated the news until we landed in Singapore. I called Kudlow to find out what had happened, and he said things had ended in good order, but for Trudeau's press conference. The immediate issue was what Kudlow should say on the Sunday talk shows, and Trump's direction was clear. Just go after Trudeau. Don't knock the others. Trudeau's a behind-your-back guy. Trump also wanted to invoke the coming Kim Jong-un meeting, saying that rejecting the G7 communique showed, "We don't take any shit," a point definitely worth making. There was no doubt Trump wanted Kudlow and Peter Navarro, another assistant to the president whom I briefed, unleashed, as well as Lindsey Graham, whom I also briefed. Navarro said, "There was a special place in hell for Trudeau because of the way he had treated Trump." Navarro was criticized, but it was just what Trump wanted. Looking more tired than before, as if he had not slept much on the flight, Trump was now obsessed with watching press coverage of Kim Jong-un's arrival in Singapore and what coverage of his own arrival early Sunday evening would be. After landing, Trump decided he didn't want to wait until Tuesday to meet Kim, but wanted to meet on Monday. I agreed. Although we had scheduled downtime for Trump to prepare and recover from jet lag before coming face-to-face with Kim, the less time we spent in Singapore, the less time there was to make concessions. If we could escape Singapore without complete disaster, we might be able to get things back on track. On Monday, Trump met with Singaporean Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong at the Astana Palace, former residence of British Governors General, and now the Prime Minister's residence and main office. Pompeo and I rode with Trump in the Beast, the presidential limo's informal name, and found him in a bad mood. He thought the Kim meeting would fail, and he attributed that to Chinese pressure. Trump and Lee had a one-on-one, and then Lee hosted a working lunch. Singaporean Foreign Minister Balakrishnan had just visited Pyongyang to prepare for the summit and said North Korea was not hurting economically and believed they were a nuclear weapons state. Trump replied that he had taken a long flight for a short meeting. Balakrishnan said the U.S. had already given away three things. First, having the meeting to begin with, a give that everyone except Trump saw. Second, the difficulty in returning to our maximum pressure campaign, also obvious to everyone but Trump. And third, to China, because we were focusing on North Korea when China was the real strategic game. Balakrishnan was very convincing, and Trump couldn't have been happy to hear any of it. After lunch, back at our hotel, Pompeo briefed us on the state of negotiations with North Korea, where we were at an impasse. "This is an exercise in publicity," said Trump, which is how he saw the entire summit. Kelly said to me while Trump did a meet-and-greet with the Singapore U.S. Embassy staff, "The psychology here is that Trump wants to walk out in order to preempt Kim Jong-un." I agreed, and became somewhat hopeful we could avoid major concessions. After the meet-and-greet, Trump told Sanders, Kelly, and me he was prepared to sign a substance-free communique, have his press conference to declare victory, and then get out of town. Trump complained that Kim Jong-un had been meeting with China and Russia to put us at a disadvantage, but he said Singapore would be a success no matter what, saying, "We just need to put on more sanctions, including on China for opening the border. Kim is full of shit. We have 300 more sanctions we can impose on Friday." This all threw logistics back into disarray. Not that they had been in much array since we left Canada, but Kelly and I said we'd get back to him with options later that day. Trump spoke to Moon Jae-in, who still wanted to come to Singapore, but it should have been apparent to Moon by then that there wasn't going to be a trilateral meeting. He wasn't even in the right country. We also showed Trump the brief recruitment video the NSC staff and others had produced to lure Kim with the promise of economic success for Pyongyang if he gave up nuclear weapons. Trump agreed to show it to Kim on Tuesday, and he later played it at his closing press conference. Negotiations with the North continued through the day, purportedly reaching near agreement. I reviewed what was marked as the 6 p.m. text shortly thereafter with a group of state, defense, and NSC officials. I told them flatly I would not recommend Trump sign it. Pompeo and other state people then arrived, and we met in the White House staff area to discuss the text. I explained again why I wouldn't sign it, even if all the language still in dispute were resolved favorably to the U.S., which was unlikely. North Korea was refusing to agree to complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization, even though they had repeatedly done so before. They weren't rejecting just magic words, but the entire concept, which rendered the whole summit meaningless to me. I said we shouldn't agree to any language about the end of the war without getting something concrete in return. Pompeo grew increasingly agitated, as he had over the phone to me in Mar-a-Lago in April discussing withdrawal from the Iran deal. I made the point that congressional Democrats would rip us to pieces on this text because that's what they did, and congressional Republicans would rip us because they knew it was inconsistent with everything they and we believed. Pompeo didn't defend the language I criticized, and he understood we were better off not signing any document rather than signing a bad one. All Pompeo knew was that Trump wanted to sign something. He couldn't bring himself to admit, at least in front of the state staffers, what we both knew, that they had led us into a cul-de-sac, where we conceded one point after another and got nothing in return. Now, here we were at the very last moment with few options, none of them good. There was a second or two of silence, and then, as if by unspoken consent, everyone else exited, leaving just Pompeo and me in the room. After going back and forth for a while, we agreed we would insist on including references to our notion of denuclearization and Security Council Resolution 1718, requiring North Korea not to conduct nuclear tests or ballistic missile launches, adding new paragraphs on the Japanese abductee issue, and pledging the return of U.S.-Korean War remains. If this didn't work, we would revert to a very brief statement, the principal virtue of which was that it would be short. Pompeo and I explained this to the state, defense, and NSC officials, all knowing they were likely to go long into the night negotiating. Trump had already crashed earlier for his own good, frankly, and would sleep until Tuesday morning. NSC Asia Senior Director Matt Pottinger woke me at 1 a.m. to say the negotiations had stalled, no surprise, and that Pompeo and Kim Jong-chol would meet at 7 a.m. at the Capella Hotel, the venue for the later Trump-Kim meeting, to see what could be done. Trump finally emerged at 8 a.m., and we left for the Capella. Trump declared himself satisfied with the short statement that we had come up with, which surprised me because it came nowhere near declaring an end to the Korean War. In fact, it didn't say much of anything. We had dodged another bullet. During all this, Trump was preparing a tweet on a 5-4 Supreme Court victory in an Ohio voting case and also wishing a speedy recovery to Kudlow, who had had a heart incident, fortunately minor, possibly brought on by the G7. Then we were off to the Trump-Kim arrival ceremony and meeting. then their one-on-one, followed by Kim Jong-un and four aides entering the room where the main meeting was to take place. He shook hands with the U.S. side, including yours truly, and we sat down and let the press take pictures for what seemed like an eternity. When the mob finally departed, Kim speculated, all through interpreters, what kinds of stories they would try to cook up, and Trump objected to the tremendous dishonesty in the press. Trump said he thought the one-on-one meeting had been very positive and anticipated that the two leaders would have direct contact over the telephone thereafter. Laughing, Kim distinguished Trump from his three predecessors, saying that they would not have shown the leadership to hold the summit. Trump preened, saying that Obama had been ready to make significant mistakes on North Korea without even talking first, alluding to their initial meeting, presumably during the transition. Trump said he knew he and Kim were going to get along almost immediately. In response, Kim asked how Trump assessed him, and Trump answered that he loved that question. He saw Kim as really smart, quite secretive, a very good person, totally sincere, with a great personality. Kim said that in politics, people are like actors. Trump was correct on one point. Kim Jong-un knew just what he was doing when he asked what Trump thought of him. It was a question designed to elicit a positive response or risk ending the meeting right there. By asking a seemingly naive or edgy question, Kim actually threw the burden and risk of answering on the other person. It showed he had Trump hooked. Kim claimed strenuously that he was committed to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Even though he knew there were people who doubted his sincerity, those people were mistakenly judging him by the actions of his predecessors. He was different. Trump agreed that Kim had changed things totally. Following the decades-old standard North Korean line, however, Kim blamed the troubled U.S.-North Korea history on the hostile policies of past U.S. administrations. He said that as he and Trump met frequently, they could work to dispel mistrust and accelerate the pace of denuclearization. I had heard all this before, but Trump had not, and he agreed with Kim's assessment, noting that there were some very militant people on the U.S. side, especially with regard to Kim's criticism of past U.S. administrations. Interestingly, Trump said he would seek Senate approval of any nuclear agreement with North Korea, contrasting his approach positively with Obama's unwillingness to seek ratification of the Iran nuclear deal. At this point, Pompeo passed me his notepad on which he had written, "He is so full of shit." I agreed. Kim promised there would be no further nuclear tests and that their nuclear program would be dismantled in an irreversible manner. Then came the catch, perfected by Joseph Stalin in his wartime summits with Franklin Roosevelt when hardliners were first discovered in the Soviet Politburo. Kim confessed that he had domestic political hurdles he could not easily overcome because there were hardliners in North Korea as well as America. Kim needed a way to build public support in North Korea, he said, actually maintaining a straight face, and he bored in on the South Korean-U.S. joint exercises, which, he said, got on people's nerves. Kim wanted us to reduce the scope or eliminate the exercises altogether. He said he had raised the military exercises with Moon in their first summit, which had produced the Panmunjom Declaration, and Moon had said that only the U.S. could make the decision. Trump answered exactly as I feared, reiterating to Kim his constant refrain that the exercises were provocative and a waste of time and money. He said he would override his generals, who could never make a deal, and decide that there would be no exercises as long as the two sides were negotiating in good faith. He said brightly that Kim had saved the United States a lot of money. Kim was smiling broadly, laughing from time to time, joined by Kim Jong-chol. You bet. We certainly were having fun. In later U.S. press coverage, there were leaks, obviously from DOD, that Mattis was displeased he was not consulted before Trump made this concession. Of course, neither were Kelly, Pompeo, nor I, and we were sitting right there. Trump said he had known from his first day in office that for him, deal-making or negotiating such as this summit would be easy. Trump asked Kelly and Pompeo if they agreed. Both said yes. Luckily, he didn't ask me. Kim said the hardliners in North Korea would be impressed by Trump's decision on the exercises, and that further steps could be taken in the next phase of the negotiations. He joked that there would be no more comparisons of the sizes of their respective nuclear buttons, because the U.S. was no longer under threat from North Korea, agreeing to dismantle a rocket engine test facility. As the meeting continued, Kim congratulated himself and Trump for all that they had accomplished in just 1 hour, and Trump agreed that others couldn't have done it. They both laughed. Trump then pointed to Kim and said he was the only one that mattered. Kim agreed he was doing things his way and that he and Trump would get along. Trump returned to the military exercises, again criticizing his generals, whom he was overruling to give the point to Kim at this meeting. Kim laughed again. Trump mused that 6 months earlier he was calling Kim Little Rocket Man and asked if Kim knew who Elton John was. He thought Rocket Man was a compliment. Kim kept laughing. At this point, Trump asked that we play the Korean language version of the recruitment film, which the North Korean side watched very intently on the iPads we gave them. When it ended, Trump and Kim wanted to sign the joint statement as soon as possible, but it turned out that translation inconsistencies were holding it up, so the conversation continued. Kim repeated that they had had a good discussion, saying he was glad that he and Trump had agreed to follow the action-for-action approach. Somehow I had missed Trump making that concession, but those were indeed magic words, exactly the ones I wanted to avoid, but which Kim thought he was walking away with. Kim asked if UN sanctions would be the next step, and Trump said he was open to it and wanted to think about it, noting that we had literally hundreds of new sanctions poised to announce. Pompeo and I had no idea what he meant. Trump handed out mints to the North Koreans. Kim was optimistic about moving forward quickly and wondered why their predecessors had been unable to do so. Trump answered quickly that they had been stupid. Kim agreed that it took the likes of him and Trump to accomplish all this. Then, a delicate moment. Kim looked across the table and asked what the others on our side of the table thought. Trump asked Pompeo to start, and Pompeo said that only the two leaders could agree on the day's historic document. Trump said happily that the U.S. couldn't have made the deal with Tillerson, who was like a block of granite. Fortunately, Kim changed the subject to returning American war remains, and I didn't have to speak. A second bullet dodged. Official photographers from both sides then entered, and the meeting ended at about 11:10. After stopping briefly in a holding room for Trump to check out the massive ongoing television coverage, we started a working lunch at 11:30. Another press mob stumbled in and then out, and Kim said, "It's like a day in fantasy land." Finally, something I completely agreed with. The opening conversation was light, with Kim's describing his visit the night before to Sheldon Adelson's Sands Casino and Hotel Complex, one of the standouts of Singapore's nightlife. Kim and Trump talked about golf, Dennis Rodman, and the U.S. women's soccer teams defeating North Korea in the 2016 Olympics. The conversation drifted around, and then Trump turned to me and said, "John was once a hawk, but now he's a dove. Anything to say after that introduction?" Fortunately, everyone laughed. Trying to keep a straight face, I said, "The president was elected in large part because he was different from other politicians. He's a disruptor. I look forward to visiting Pyongyang. It will certainly be interesting." Kim thought that was funny for some reason and said, "You will be warmly welcomed. You may find this hard to answer, but do you think you can trust me?" This was tricky. One of those questions he was good at asking. I couldn't either tell the truth or lie, so I said, "The president has a finely tuned sense of people from his days in business. If he can trust you, we will move forward from there." Trump added that I was on Fox News all the time, calling for war with Russia, China, and North Korea, but it was a lot different on the inside. This really had all the North Koreans in stitches. Kim said, "I heard a lot about Ambassador Bolton saying not good things about us. At the end, we must have a picture so I can show the hardliners that you are not such a bad guy." "Can I go to Yongbyon?" I asked. More laughter. Trump said, "John is a big believer in this, I can tell you," showing just how far the truth could be stretched. I added, "Mr. Chairman, I'm delighted you watch Fox News." And everyone laughed. Trump told me on the flight back to Washington, "I rehabilitated you with them." Just what I needed. The lunch ended shortly thereafter at 12:30, but we were still stuck because the joint statements weren't ready. Trump and Kim decided to walk in the hotel garden, which produced endlessly rebroadcast television footage, but nothing else. Finally, we held the signing ceremony. The North Korean delegation was very impressive. They all clapped in perfect unison, loud and hard, for example, whenever Kim said or did something noteworthy, which was quite a contrast with the raggedy performance of the U.S. delegation. Trump did several one-on-one press interviews before the huge media event began shortly after 4 p.m., when he unexpectedly played our recruitment video. The coverage was extraordinary. And then we were off to Washington, my fondest wish, before anything else went wrong. Shortly after Air Force One was airborne, Trump called Moon and then Abe to brief them. Pompeo stayed in Singapore, traveling on to Seoul, Beijing, and Tokyo to provide more detailed readouts of what had happened. Trump told Moon that things could not have gone better, and they both spoke glowingly of what was accomplished. Trump asked Moon, a little belatedly, about how to implement the agreement, repeating what he said in the press conference, that he had been up for 27 straight hours, something Kelly and I knew for sure was not true. Moon stressed, as Seoul's representatives did subsequently in public statements, that Kim had made a clear commitment to denuclearization. Abe expressed gratitude that Trump had brought up the abductee issue in his one-on-one with Kim, not wanting to rain on the parade. Trump said he believed Kim wanted to make a deal. It was time to close on one. I also made briefing calls, speaking particularly to Pence, to discuss the war games point, which congressional Republicans were already criticizing. Pompeo, stuck in Singapore because his plane had engine problems, said Mattis had called him, quite worried about the concession. Pompeo and I agreed the two of us, Mattis and Dunford, should talk once we all returned to Washington to think through what to do to avoid dangerous impairments to U.S. readiness on the peninsula. Our approach should be, don't just do something, sit there, until we assessed what was necessary. This point was proven when I was in Trump's Air Force One office with him watching Fox News. A reporter, citing an unnamed Pentagon spokesman, said planning for exercises was continuing as before, sending Trump through the roof. Trump wanted me to call Mattis and have him stop everything, but I instead asked Mira Ricardel, also on Air Force One, to call others at the Pentagon to tell them to avoid public statements until told otherwise. We landed at Andrews a little after 5:30 a.m. on Wednesday, June 13th, and Trump motorcaded back to the White House. My Secret Service detail drove around the Washington Beltway to my home, and I noticed on the way that Trump tweeted out, "Just landed. A long trip, but everybody can now feel much safer than the day I took office. There is no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea. Meeting with Kim Jong-un was an interesting and very positive experience. North Korea has great potential for the future." There was no stopping it. I spoke with Yachi the next day, and the Japanese, in my judgment, were clearly concerned about what we had given away and how little we had gotten in return. I tried to keep things calm, but the Singapore outcome was ambiguous enough that we needed to reel things back in or risk rapidly losing control of events. Both Japan and South Korea were particularly confused about the approach Trump seemed to take in his conversations with Moon and Abe, saying Moon in particular would be the closer on the nuclear deal. What exactly did the president have in mind? They wanted to know. Neither Pompeo nor I had the slightest idea, but we were also both certain neither did Trump. In fact, I was revising my earlier view, wondering if greater South Korean involvement in denuclearization might not complicate things so much that we could prevent a total collapse of both our nuclear non-proliferation policy and our conventional deterrence strategy on the peninsula and in East Asia more broadly. I also spoke with Mattis regarding the war games and explained how I thought we should proceed. Mattis said his Japanese and South Korean counterparts were already calling him, understandably very concerned. He also said, which I had not heard before, that 6 months earlier, Trump had also almost canceled the exercises because Russia and China complained about them, which was disturbing to say the least. Dunford was compiling a list of exercises that might be affected, and we agreed to meet back in Washington. But Mattis wouldn't leave well enough alone, saying later that day he wanted to issue a press statement. Whatever it said, in my view, risked another presidential edict, the substance of which Mattis would doubtless dislike. Why roll the dice? Probably because it was a Defense Department bureaucratic ploy. If the Pentagon could produce enough blowback in Congress, it could avoid responsibility for any degradation in readiness in Korea. But it was a risky strategy, given the danger Trump might make his exercises prohibition even more sweeping and stringent. Mattis finally agreed his department would remain silent. But it was an effort. Pompeo, Mattis, and I met for breakfast in the wardroom on Monday, June 18th, by which time Dunford's list of exercises was complete. Mattis argued that readiness started to deteriorate when any exercises were canceled, and the decline would accelerate the more time passed. We were all concerned about the objective, both near and long term, of not degrading readiness on the peninsula. As regularly scheduled officer rotations began to ripple through the ranks and new people replaced more experienced people, the lack of exercises could take its toll. This discussion made September 1st a potentially important date. Mattis was worried about canceling too few exercises and incurring Trump's wrath, but I thought it was ridiculous to cancel too many, provoking unnecessary confrontations with Hill Republicans and only making things worse. We finally agreed the Pentagon would issue a statement that the two biggest annual exercises would be suspended, a key word, we thought, that is, not canceled. Overall, however, and remembering that the Chinese had suggested to Pompeo in Beijing that we press very hard in the next 2 months to make progress with Pyongyang, we set September 1st as a date by which to assess whether the negotiations were, in fact, productive. During the rest of the week, after returning from Singapore, Trump was euphoric. On Friday, during an intel briefing, he exclaimed, "I never could have gotten this done with McMaster and Tillerson. Pompeo's doing a great job. This guy's doing great too," he said, pointing at me. Trump was happy there would be no more war games and said he was glad he had been overruled in his previous efforts to cancel them because otherwise he wouldn't have had something to give away. Trump also said Kim Jong-un has a vicious streak in him and that he could be mercurial, remembering an irritated look Kim Jong-un shot at one of his officials during the talks. Trump had signed notes and pictures and newspaper articles for Kim Jong-un to remember the glow of Singapore, which couldn't fade rapidly enough for me. One important point Trump made at the end of June underscored the potential of a division growing between the U.S. and Moon Jae-in, which increasingly concerned us. Having watched Moon in action, Trump came to understand that Moon had a different agenda from ours, as any government prioritizes its national interest. For Moon, this likely meant emphasizing inter-Korean relations over denuclearization. Moreover, Trump wanted good news on North Korea before the 2018 congressional election. To that end, he wanted the South to ease up on pushing for reunification with North Korea because denuclearization was the U.S. priority. That had always been an accurate statement of U.S. interests. Having it fixed in Trump's mind gave us at least one guardrail to keep us from completely losing our perspective. I worried that Trump only wanted to hear good news before the election, which was, of course, impossible to guarantee. I also worried that Pompeo particularly didn't want to be the bearer of bad news, a role too easily avoided by making concessions to North Korea. In what passed for speed in diplomacy with North Korea, Pompeo scheduled a return to Pyongyang on July 6th. I worried that state's bureaucracy was so delighted negotiations were resuming that, as in the six-party talks, each new meeting was an opportunity to give things away. Indeed, state was already drafting charts with fallback positions for the U.S. delegation before they even sat down with real live North Koreans post-Singapore. I stressed vigorously to Pompeo that no serious negotiations should begin until we had Pyongyang's commitment to provide a full baseline declaration on their nuclear and ballistic missile programs. For arms controllers, this was a basic step, if hardly one that guaranteed success. It was elemental tradecraft that negotiators would compare what was being declared to what was already known about an adversary's weapons capabilities, and that such comparisons amounted to a test of good faith in the negotiations, and in the case of North Korea, the sincerity of their commitment to denuclearization. If a country grossly misstated its nuclear assets, that would show us exactly how serious these negotiations would be. I often said that, unlike a lot of other people, I have faith in North Korea. They never let me down. I also pressed Pompeo on what NSC and IC non-proliferation experts agreed. If the North Koreans were serious on renouncing weapons of mass destruction, they would cooperate on the critical disarming work, another test of their seriousness, which could then be done in 1 year or less. State staffers wanted a much longer period for disarmament, which was a prescription for trouble. Pompeo was not enthusiastic about a rapid denuclearization schedule, perhaps because he worried that the North would resist, thus meaning bad news for Trump, who wanted none before the election, thus causing potential headaches for Pompeo. Pompeo left for Pyongyang after the 4th of July fireworks on the Mall, which he viewed from the State Department, hosting the traditional reception for foreign ambassadors. He called back to Washington on Friday evening at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning Korea time, to speak with Trump, Kelly, and me. Pompeo said he had spent 5 hours in two separate meetings with Kim Jong-chol, which had been incredibly frustrating, producing almost no progress. Pompeo had meetings again on Saturday, and he called back to Washington at 5:15 p.m. to report he had seen Kim Jong-chol again, but not Kim Jong-un, which had said a lot about who the North wanted to talk to. South Korea's Chung told me a few days later even they were surprised and disappointed there had been no Kim Jong-un meeting. After Pompeo left Pyongyang, the North described the talks as regrettable, presenting a unilateral and gangster-like demand for denuclearization. So much for all the good news. Pompeo said North Korea wanted security guarantees before denuclearization, and there would be verification only after denuclearization, not before, meaning no baseline declaration, and thus no way to have a meaningful before and after comparison. This was a total non-starter, in my view. Trump agreed, saying, "This trust building is horseshit. the smartest thing on Pyongyang he had said in months. Pompeo added, "It's all an effort to weaken the sanctions, a standard delaying tactic," which was correct. Trying to deliver some good news, Pompeo referred to an item in North Korea's press statement saying something like Kim Jong-un still has trust in President Trump. In both the Friday and Saturday phone calls, Trump asked what impact China was having on North Korea. Pompeo downplayed China's influence, whereas Trump thought it was much more important. I thought Pompeo's assessment the more accurate, though China's role was well worth watching. Then Trump was off riffing that he didn't understand why we had fought the Korean War and why we still had so many troops on the peninsula, not to mention those war games. "We're going to end being chumps," said Trump. Turning to North Korea, he said, "This is a waste of time. They're basically saying they don't want to denuke," which was clearly right. Until the end of the call, Trump didn't seem to realize Pompeo hadn't actually seen Kim Jong-un, asking if Pompeo had handed over the Trump-autographed copy of Elton John's Rocket Man CD, which Pompeo had not. Getting this CD to Kim remained a high priority for several months. Pompeo called me back separately after the Trump phone call to discuss how to handle the press in Japan, where he had stopped for refueling. The only thing that surprised me about North Korea's behavior was how quickly they became difficult after Singapore. They weren't wasting any time. Trump obviously wanted to suppress bad news so it didn't become public in the middle of the congressional campaign, especially the lack of any evidence whatever that North Korea was serious about denuclearization. So instead, he stressed the North was not testing missiles or nuclear weapons. I tried to explain that delay worked in North Korea's favor, as it usually did for proliferators. In all probability, the North was moving its weapons, missiles, and production facilities into new, more secure locations, as it had for decades, and continuing production of weapons and delivery systems, having concluded that for now at least, their testing programs had accomplished their missions. This was certainly Japan's view, shared repeatedly as in a phone call I had with Yachi on July 20th. Perhaps some items were even stored in other countries. That didn't bother Trump, who said, "They've been doing that for years." Of course they had. That was the very essence of the problem. But he again saw the contrast between the South's reunification agenda and our goal of denuclearization, and he therefore decided against signing the CORUS trade deal until Seoul demonstrated it was still tightly enforcing sanctions against Pyongyang. Perhaps he thought he could use CORUS for bargaining leverage, but while the deal's signing was slightly delayed, it was ultimately signed on September 24, 2018. But you could ignore the risks from North Korea only so long, especially since Trump believed China was behind the North's recalcitrance. He may have thought he would resolve the trade issues with China and then everything else would fall into place. If so, he was dreaming. On Friday, July 27th, I convened a principals committee to discuss what had happened since Singapore, and there was no dissent that the conclusion was nothing much. Pompeo was emphatic that North Korea had made no significant steps toward denuclearization and that there was zero probability of success. My take exactly. There was general agreement on tightening sanctions in a variety of ways, diplomatically, economically, and militarily. Neither Mattis, Pompeo, nor I raised our September 1st target date, but it was certainly on my mind with just 5 weeks to go. North Korea's approach was different. Kim sent Trump one of his famous love letters at the beginning of August, criticizing the lack of progress since Singapore and suggesting the two of them get together again soon. Pompeo and I agreed such a meeting needed to be avoided at any cost, and certainly not before the November election. Under such political pressure, who knew what Trump might give away? We also agreed the best response to the letter was to say Pompeo was ready to return to Pyongyang at any time. When I showed Trump Kim Jong-un's letter and explained our recommendation, however, Trump said immediately, "I should meet with Kim Jong-un. We should invite him to the White House." This was a potential disaster of enormous magnitude. I suggested instead meeting in New York at September's UN General Assembly opening, but Trump wasn't having it. "No, there are too many things going on then." By this time, others had come into the Oval, including Kelly, to whom I whispered on the way out, "There is no way he should meet again with Kim." Kelly completely agreed. Pompeo, traveling in Asia, called in the late afternoon, and I explained what had happened. He said, "I want to see the picture of the look on your face when POTUS said he wanted a White House visit." "That would have been hard," I said, "because they would first have had to peel me off the rug on the Oval Office floor." Trump tweeted to Kim that afternoon, "Thank you for your nice letter. I look forward to seeing you soon." Although it was dicey, we drafted a letter Trump signed the next day, offering up Pompeo in Pyongyang. Trump said he didn't like the idea, which he thought was insulting to Kim. "I disagree with you and Pompeo. It's not fair to Kim Jong-un, and I hope it doesn't ruin things," he said, as he wrote in his own hand at the bottom of the letter, "I look forward to seeing you soon." At least he signed it. Despite plans for another Pompeo trip to North Korea at the end of August, just before he was due to depart for Pyongyang, the North Koreans warned that Pompeo would not see Kim Jong-un on this trip and shouldn't even bother coming unless he was bringing completely new proposals, including the end-of-war declaration. They basically warned denuclearization was not on the agenda. But Pompeo wanted to ignore the threat and tweet that he was looking forward to meeting Kim Jong-un. Unexpectedly, Trump said Pompeo shouldn't go at all. Pence and Pompeo argued back, pushing for the trip, but Trump was still deciding how to send the message. He ultimately reverted to the comfortable Twitter mode and, as he did so often, he began dictating a tweet. "What do you think of that, John?" he asked, and I immediately said, "I agree. No way Mike should go to Pyongyang in the face of all that." Pence agreed we should show strength rather than weakness, and in short order, the tweets went out. "I have asked Secretary of State Mike Pompeo not to go to North Korea at this time because I feel we are not making sufficient progress with respect to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Additionally, because of our much tougher trading stance with China, I do not believe they are helping with the process of denuclearization as they once were, despite the UN sanctions which are in place. Secretary Pompeo looks forward to going to North Korea in the near future, most likely after our trading relationship with China is resolved. In the meantime, I would like to send my warmest regards and respect to Chairman Kim. I look forward to seeing him soon." I was delighted. Another bullet dodged. Shortly afterward, I spoke to Pompeo, who was reconciled to Trump's decision. Trump himself said a few days later, "The sanctions should be as strong as you can make them. Don't give them any breathing room. Put more sanctions on." Trump still wondered what Xi Jinping was telling Kim Jong-un, and I told him for sure it wasn't helpful. I gave Trump a one-pager I had drafted entirely on my own, speculating on what Xi might be saying, based on my years of involvement in these issues. I hoped it might wake him up or get him thinking. I had tried everything else, so I figured I had nothing to lose. Trump read the script, but didn't react to it. At least he had heard what I believed was the real situation. The transcript of my version of Xi's comments to Kim is as follows. "Look, Jong-un, you can't trust Trump no matter how many nice letters he writes. He's trying to sucker you like all capitalist salesmen. Don't fall for it. What Trump really wants is to turn North Korea into South Korea. Trump, Pompeo, and Bolton are all the same. They only appear different so they can mess with your head. Americans have short-term minds. They are erratic and inconsistent, and they can't be trusted. What's more, Moon Jae-in thinks like they do, except he's even worse. He's a pacifist. We can run all over Moon, but the Americans understand power. That's why you have to stick with me. It's the only way for you to keep your nuclear weapons program, get real financial aid, and hold on to power. If you proceed down this road of negotiations with the Americans, you're going to be hanging from a tree in Pyongyang before too long. I guarantee it. Stick with me. All you have to do is keep hiding your nuclear weapons, missiles, and production facilities. Our friends in Iran will continue testing your missiles as they have for two decades. In return, you can build them nuclear warheads in your hidden underground plants. I will buy more Iranian oil and increase our capital investment there, offsetting U.S. sanctions. Iran will do what I say after that. To deceive the U.S., keep giving back their soldiers' bones. They get very emotional about such things. Same with Japan. Send back the bodies of the people your father kidnapped. Abe will weep in public and start giving you suitcases full of dollar bills. Right now, I'm in a trade war with Trump. He's inflicting some damage on China's economy, and if this trade war continues, it could hurt us badly. Fortunately, Trump is surrounded by Wall Street advisors who are just as short-term as most Americans and just as weak as Moon Jae-in. I'll agree to buy more of their precious soybeans and some of their technology, which I will then steal and sell back to their consumers at lower prices, and that will get them to back off. When we get together next month, I'll explain in more detail. I'll also lay out aid packages that even Japan can't match. I won't violate any UN sanctions because I won't have to. I'll provide supplies and assistance the sanctions don't cover, and I'll hold the border police up from watching too closely at what's going on. You'll be fine. Not only do you not have to give up your nukes, pretty soon you'll be able to have South Korea fall into your lap like ripe fruit. Think long term, Jong-un. You want to be on the winning side of history, and that's China. The Americans are no friends of ours. On August 29th, for some reason, Mattis and Dunford held a disastrous press conference, during which Mattis was asked about U.S. forces Korea's readiness in light of the war games being suspended. He gave a long, confused answer, the substance of which, however, taken fairly, indicated a split from Trump on the issue. That set Trump off, not surprisingly, riffing about what was wrong with Mattis, the generals, war games, and so on. I said Mattis was working to clear up the confusion, but Trump wanted to tweet, which he did later. Statement from the White House. President Donald J. Trump feels strongly that North Korea is under tremendous pressure from China because of our major trade disputes with the Chinese government. At the same time, we also know that China is providing North Korea with considerable aid, including money, fuel, fertilizer, and various other commodities. This is not helpful. Nonetheless, the president believes that his relationship with Kim Jong-un is a very good and warm one, and there is no reason at this time to be spending large amounts of money on joint U.S.-South Korea war games. Besides, the president can instantly start the joint exercises again with South Korea and Japan if he so chooses. If he does, they will be far bigger than ever before. As for the U.S.-China trade disputes and other differences, they will be resolved in time by President Trump and China's great president, Xi Jinping. Their relationship and bond remain very strong. I thought this was all mostly laughable, but it didn't undercut our basic positions. In Trump White House terms, this was a victory, a good day at the office. The next day, China criticized the tweets, more progress in my view. Mattis told Pompeo and me at our weekly breakfast in the wardroom on August 30th that he regretted even having the press conference that precipitated this, and I doubted he would hold another for a long time. Moon and Trump spoke on September 4th. Trump complained that he had had a phenomenal meeting in Singapore and that a good friendship with Kim had been built, and now suddenly there's no deal. He wondered what had happened. Of course, Singapore had not been phenomenal unless you were a North Korean. KJU didn't make friends with his enemies, and there wasn't a real deal. Other than that, Moon was still singing the Sunshine Policy song, saying Kim was entirely committed to improving relations with the United States and denuclearizing. But Kim Jong-chol and others around him had rude manners. An interesting surmise. Moon suggested that Trump meet again with Kim Jong-un. Just what we needed. Moon was still pressing for his own summit with Kim in mid-September, something he likely wanted for domestic political reasons. Pompeo, Kelly, and I gave Trump another Kim Jong-un letter on September 10th, which he read in the Oval, commenting as he went, "This is a wonderful letter. This is a really nice letter. And listen to what he says about me," followed by his reading one oleaginous passage after another. As Kelly and I said later, it was as if the letter had been written by Pavlovians who knew exactly how to touch the nerves enhancing Trump's self-esteem. Trump wanted to meet Kim, and he didn't want to hear anything contrary, which is probably why he didn't want to hear me explaining that another meeting soon was a bad idea. "John, you have a lot of hostility," he said, to which I replied, "The letter is written by the dictator of a rat-shit little country. He doesn't deserve another meeting with you until he has met with Pompeo, as he agreed to just a couple of weeks ago." "You have such hostility," said Trump. "Of course, I have the most hostility, but you have a lot of hostility." On we went until, out of nowhere, Trump said, "I want the meeting the first week after the election, and Mike should call today and ask for it. You should say the Kim letter is extremely nice. The president has great affection for Chairman Kim. He wants to release the letter because it's so good for the public to see the strength of the relationship, and he wants to have a meeting after the election. Where would he like to meet?" Outside the Oval, Kelly said to me, "I'm sorry that meeting was so rough on you," and Pompeo seemed discouraged. I said I was ecstatic at the outcome. After all, we had just gained a 5-week delay in any possible Trump-Kim meeting, during which time anything could happen in Trump world. We should take it and run. A continuing, very significant problem was Trump's relentless desire to withdraw U.S. military assets from the Korean Peninsula, part of his general reduction of U.S. forces worldwide. September 1st came and went, and Mattis reaffirmed in early October his concern for our military readiness on the peninsula. He and Dunford would have to testify in Congress after January 1st during the budget process, and it seemed hard to imagine the problem wouldn't surface then. Pompeo finally obtained another meeting with Kim Jong-un in mid-October, where Kim complained at length about our economic sanctions, but offered little in new ideas from his side. The main outcome of the meeting was to restart working-level discussions, which I considered inevitable, but bad news nonetheless. Here is where the U.S. concession train would really start steaming along. But we had at least survived past the November congressional elections without any major disasters and could now face the next round of Trump enthusiasm to meet with Kim Jong-un.